Hi there, this is Dan Delta Collins. You're listening to Wandering DMs. Wandering DMs is broadcast live every Sunday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on twitch.tv/wanderingdms and also youtube.com/wanderingdms. We hope you enjoy the show.
DM's livecast. I'm Paul.
And I'm Dan, and today we're going to be talking about improvisation and training new DMs.
So this topic came to us from a reader of our blogs who emailed both of us with a really thought-provoking question, and Dan and I started talking about it. Actually, it's a little bit of the progenitor of us even doing the livecast was, hey, we should talk about this in front of people, so here we are. So maybe, Dan, you can summarize for us what was in that email.
Yeah, so a reader named both of our blogs named William Heilman, wrote in talking about one of the main tenets of the old school Renaissance, the OSR. He's pointing out his rulings, not rules, is a lot of people emphasize improvisationally making up judgments on the fly and not looking things up in a book and not expecting to have an encyclopedic set of rules that they're looking at. And he was saying, well, that works perfectly fine for those of us that have a really, really deep experience running games and have experience with what works and what doesn't work. But is that going to work for new DMs? Is that a philosophy that's going to work for a first-time DM not having that same depth of experience or not? And that seemed like a pretty good question, and it's not something that I've personally thought of before. So, Paul, what are your initial thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, we touched on a couple of these topics a little bit last time we spoke, at least in terms of improv and rulings not rules, which again I believe the best I can credit that to is. Finch's old school primer. It's funny because, yes, certainly experience helps. I will definitely say experience helps. But I don't necessarily think that like encyclopedic knowledge of rule systems helps. Because ultimately we're talking about improv, right? You're talking about like making it up on the spot. So presumably you're trying to do something that's not covered in a rule somewhere.
Right.
Does that
right.
make sense? I don't know. I feel like I've gotten a little rambly there. It's a broad topic. I don't know. Improv in general. You run a game for a bunch of improv actors, right, Dan?
Yeah, which is fantastic. And it's definitely been an opportunity to evolve my game, kind of watching their art form. So I do run a game here in Brooklyn, New York, where most, not all, but most of the players do comedy in the city, mostly improv at UCB and stuff, places like that. And it's been a really nice opportunity to kind of look at their art form, see how they approach it, see what works and what doesn't, and then think about kind of more explicitly working that into my games. And certainly, so I'm, historically a literalist, and I'm someone who pays attention to the written word very, very, very closely. I'm, maybe a little bit OCD, maybe. And so it's been a nice opportunity to kind of walk in a little bit of a different direction and embrace the improvisational element and embrace coming into a game not knowing what's going to happen and embracing the surprise and the pleasure. And kind of trying to be more flexible about the voices that I use and things like that. So it's really a funny serendipity that that my players are almost all involved in that art form. And right while we're talking about how important it is to the game of D&D.
Yeah. I mean, I think that like the area we touched on in trying to define what is old school, we talked a lot about having very few written words, right? Thus
right.
forcing ourselves down this road of making more stuff up on the fly. So I guess, so then the subsequent question, right, in the email was, is it reasonable to expect a new GM to be able to do this? What do you think?
There's a part of it. I mean, my first reaction is that there's a premise of the question that I actually don't entirely agree with. So the rulings, not rules bit, I would actually say rules are actually really important, but they have to be small and they have to be short and they have to be concise. So I would certainly, I mean, for me, I think I get better the shorter the rule set is that I'm working with. And so I would say having really good rules that are very short that you can remember is a really important backbone to the discipline. Eh? Is that okay word?
Sure. Why not?
The discipline to the art form?
Well, there's some individuals out there making a living as professional DMs. It exists.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and there always has been, right? And I would read about that in, you know, circa 1980. That's always been a thing.
That's
have you ever made money? Have you ever done that for pay?
I've not, but I do know some people who do.
Right, neither have I.
But I don't know anybody who does it full time, though I have read articles about that. Digressing a bit here. The interesting thing is when you talk about minimalist rules, I think that my improvisational style is the absolute minimum of rules. That basically, I boil it down to two. Use common sense and ask the dice.
Yeah. Do you always ask the dice, or are there any circumstances where you say that's clearly not going to happen, or that clearly is going to be successful?
I definitely do not always ask the dice. However, I find asking the dice very freeing, right? So let me just expound on that a little bit. Ask the dice is something I think I'm stealing from maybe Grognardia, where he had a wonderful post about the oracular power of dice.
Exactly. Right? Yeah.
And the gist of it is simply that, like, if A could happen or B could happen, then roll some dice and find out, right? Assign some probability, roll some dice that emulate that probability and go with that. The interesting thing about ask the dice is if I think it's obvious, or if I can't sort of visualize or think of potentially what the outcome will be in one side or the other, then I don't do it, right? That's especially, like, I think that's a pitfall that a lot of GMs fall into, is that I'm going to roll the dice even though I haven't really thought out what it means to fail, and in fact failing would completely ruin the game. So why are you doing it?
Yes.
So you definitely, I think, you need to think about the stakes. What are they? What's going to happen if I succeed versus what happens if I'm going to fail?
Like, I like to say out loud to the players now, like, here's what's going to happen if it's a success. Here's what's going to happen if it's going to fail. Even if it doesn't totally 100% make sense in world that you would know that in advance, but I like to tell the players to set those stakes very, you know, out loud explicitly.
Yeah, that's nice. I mean, it gives them a chance to sort of know, you know, what they're risking and possibly take it back and say, like, oh, really?
Yeah.
I had imagined it was going to be easy, and you're imagining it's going to be hard. So maybe let's get more on the same page.
Great point.
So, but I think the freeing thing about asking the dice is that the more I think about that, the more I keep that in the back of my head, anytime I'm posed a question by players and I don't immediately know the answer, then I go to the dice, right? And it's something, it really helps the speed of the game. I go, is it raining? I don't know. It's not important to my written adventure whether it's raining or not. Let's ask the dice.
Great. So you're saying dice plural.
Hmm.
What is your normal go-to dice to make that decision?
It's actually usually just one die.
Yeah.
And I will use a D6 if the odds are really simple. Like, if it's 50-50, then a D6 is just super easy for me. If I want a relatively low probability, then I'll switch to a D20. Because I start to think in increments of 5%.
Okay.
And I go like, maybe there's a 10% chance, so one or two on a D20. Here we go.
Okay, I'm finding that I'm becoming like almost married to the D6. Hmm. Like, in anything that's off book, I'm finding it pretty, like, the more I do it, the more obvious it is to me to measure things on a D6.
Interesting.
And so I can pretty quickly approximate whether I feel it's one or two or three and six. And so I almost always go for a D6 nowadays.
Yeah.
If it's something that's off book.
The difference between what I was just saying of a 1 or 2 on a D20 and a 1 on a D6 is probably not significant enough for anyone to really care about.
I agree, particularly if it's something that's unknown and off book.
Right.
Yeah, I agree. It's funny because if you look at original D&D, you know, it's almost all about D20s and D6s, right? Like the books say you ought to have a couple D20s, you ought to have a giant batch of D6s, and then, oh, since you're going to be buying polyhedrons, we also took some time and worked in all the other dice.
Right. I mean, I remember hearing that recently. Maybe this is apocryphal, but I remember hearing the notion that originally it was supposed to be D20s and D6s.
Yeah.
And then based on the supplier of the dice, they were like, oh, well, I guess we have all these other dice. Let's make up rules for them.
Yeah. If you look at like the second page of the original D&D rules, that's basically you can kind of detect that. Mm-hmm. And the only place you see the other polyhedral dice is they worked it into the Wandering Monster tables. And there are times when I really wish that there was like this pure just D20 and a bunch of D6s game. And I kind of walk my game more in that direction all the time.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I guess I probably, if I think about it hard, I probably really do use the D6 a lot more frequently than I would use a D20.
Right.
I might use the D20, especially if I want to, say, associate it with an ability. So that's a common trope, right, of like, well, can I or can I not open this door? I guess that's based on strength, so roll a D20 and add your strength score.
Yeah, that's common. I mean, so obviously that one actually is in the original D&D books, and that is supposed to be a D6.
Right. I know. I went too simple.
How dare you? How dare you?
Sorry. Too simple of my made up on the spot situation.
But a lot of people do that with ability scores versus the D20. So I.
Right. Right. Yeah. So I don't know, a dex check to jump. I mean, heck, we have vocabulary for it, right? We call it a dex check. What does that even mean? That's not particularly old school, I don't think, right? I don't think the concept of an ability check.
I agree. Yeah. Yeah. That was a later development. Yeah.
Now because I've been using your target 20 system, I now invert all my numbers and it always catches my players by surprise where I say, oh, roll a D20 and add your total dex and
Great.
See if you get a 20 or higher. And it always takes them like the whole dex, like not just the modifier. Like, yeah,
right.
Yeah, the whole score.
Yeah, for me, I actually do all that kind of stuff. I do on a D6. So like using the open door strength check as an example. Like if I was having people jump over a pit or climb a wall or anything like that, I do all that stuff on a D6 with the actual modifier.
That makes sense.
And probabilistically, it's almost the same thing. D6 is just about one third of a D20. And if you're doing anything remotely like D20 system plus one per 3 points, then it works out probabilistically almost exactly the same. So it's fine either way. But I tend to do those things on a D6 like original would do with doors.
I may have to give that a whirl.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, okay. So the question was, is it reasonable for a new DM to do this, right? Certainly, I think those two rules of thumb that I propose of use common sense, ask the dice, and I think actually now that we're saying it out loud, I think that order is important, right? Use common sense trumps ask the dice.
Great, I like it. Yeah, I like it.
And then, can a new DM do that?
Well, it's a good question, and you know, it's funny because so I have like just always had the role of DM, so. I was, and this is probably, if we do this for a while, this is going to be a common theme. So in my little town in Maine, I was the first person to get the D&D books. I did not have any kind of mentor. There was no other D&D group in the town. And so from day one, I was the person who read, well, it was right here. So Holmes, Basic D&D, and it's 48 pages long. And so from day one, I was always the person who was the DM. And sometimes maybe I have blinders on about cultivating other people to be DMs. And sometimes it looks more complicated than it probably should be.
I mean, that's interesting, right? I think that you and I kind of had vaguely similar-ish experiences, at least in our youth.
Right.
When I was young, I had no one to play with, and I was just reading the books and hoping that maybe one day I might get to play. I think I had the Moldvay basic set because my dad bought it for my mom because she likes that sort of thing. And she probably looked at it once and said, what the hell is this, and put it on a shelf in her closet for me to find a couple years later. So I read it. I think it wasn't until high school, though, that I had a group to actually, like, play with regularly.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah, yeah. And even then, I was pretty often the DM.
Yeah.
I had one other friend who was also, would then sometimes be the DM.
Interesting.
But I think we were both kind of learning by doing. I don't think either one of us were, like, trained or had a mentor or anything like that. And I always get the feeling whenever I hear about other people who have become DMs that often there is a mentorship or an older person who taught them the ropes.
Yeah, a lot of the time if this comes up in an online discussion, like 9 people out of 10 will say it's impossible to learn D&D from a book. Like, obviously, everybody had a group and a mentor that trained them, starting with either Gary or Dave. And there'll be a very small number of voices that go, no, I actually learned from a book. And then again, 90% of the people will be going, really? I wouldn't have believed that was possible.
I mean, it certainly wasn't easy. And I can say, looking back, like, you know, now, as a sort of amateur D&D historian, I know about all the different editions and when they came out and what their influences were. But back then, I had the basic set and then I had the Monster Manual. And I probably got the first edition AD&D Player's Handbook, but not the DMG.
Yeah.
Somehow I thought this was all the same game, and I mashed it together and played it.
Yeah. Yeah, I think and that's very common. And, I mean, heck, obviously the Monster Manual is, you know, it's got AD&D on the cover, but all the numbers are exactly the same as original D&D. So it's there's a lot of crossover there, and a lot of people did that.
Yeah, so it's interesting. I think having the Player's Handbook and not the Dungeon Master's Guide is a little awkward when you're just looking at AD&D. There's gaps. There's definitely places where you have to fill in. And maybe, I don't know, maybe that's why I like that to this day, is I'm used to that kind of play where, yep, there are some things that I just can't, there's no rule here in this book for. I guess I'm going to have to make it up.
Yeah, that makes sense. That makes sense. I think if there was a new DM, and maybe I should work better at cultivating people to do this. So I'm always encouraging people around me to do that, and a lot of people like feel like it's overwhelming. But like the very first thing would be like get a limited scenario, right? So obviously you, Paul, and myself are a lot of the time we're running whole worlds now with a wilderness and encounter tables in which like any monster could possibly show up. But if I think a new DM, what they ought to do is like maybe get a one-page dungeon, something really limited. Yep. Just think in advance about how to run those 12 rooms properly and use that as a starting point. And you certainly, if you start out with a limited dungeon, then you don't have to think that you're going to run the whole world with the entire rule set.
So I went through an exercise recently where I had this grand idea to like sort of go around and sow the seeds of D&D for new players.
Yeah.
And I had built an adventure, not really built, I stole an adventure from Dyson Logos. I used his Dyson's Delve, which is a mini mega dungeon. But I just stole the first level off of that. And I think I have a blog post about this where I said, I modified it in these couple of small ways. And I played that many times with new players just as an intro. And I would totally hold that up as a great example for new DMs of give this one a try.
Great. Yeah. And obviously, so I was one of your players, through that at one point, and it's a great great scaled adventure. So I would, as a player, I would certainly sign off on that myself.
The nice thing about that there is when I was running it as an intro adventure, I just ran that first level. You played a lot more of Dyson's Delve, and I think that's actually, really good for this use case, right? You have a fairly self-contained, here's just a quickie little adventure that you can run over a session or two with your friends. And then when they say, we want more, here's 11 more pages.
Right. Yeah, right.
Which is pretty nice.
I had, so it's interesting because one of our players in our group about 2 weeks ago ran not D&D, but a Dungeon World, I think, is what it is. So it's actually way more improvisational and it's way more player, I guess they'd say narrative driven. And it was an interesting experience. He came away and later said, afterwards I realized I screwed a whole bunch of stuff up. I broke this rule. And I said to him, yeah, but we all do that. We always do that. And so I always come away and afterwards I have to make like a page of notes about things I'm going to fix or adjust next time. And of course, I have giant, so somewhere behind me, I have very large stacks of rule mistakes that I personally made that I need to fix in the future. So, you know, I would say feel free to try it, to make mistakes and to adjust, because no matter how long we do this, we're all doing that all the time.
I mean, that's a really interesting point. I definitely think that I learn a lot by running the same adventure for multiple groups of players.
Yeah.
Would you advise that of a new DM?
If you can swing it, I absolutely. And I wish I could do that more often. You know, it's the law of software engineering. The more times you can test it, the better. I wish that I could do that more often. I'm not sure everybody in the world is going to have the capacity to make that happen.
Right.
But if they can, it's a wonderful experience.
Yep. Awesome. So, I don't know, maybe, so here's an interesting thing. Okay. So we have some ideas, some notes that we would give to a new DM, some material that we would recommend. How do we find these new DMs and get it into their hands?
Well, you seem to have more experience than that. What has your experience been? Are you still doing that project you're talking about?
That was really the interesting. I only ran it actually a limited number of times, and then I realized I had run out of venues in which to do it. I had tried, I think, for a little while to like reach out to libraries and such that I was. I don't know. It was a grand idea in my head that just never quite came to fruition. But even in that case, I still don't think I was training DMs, right? I was introducing players who were like, what's this D&D thing? To mm-hmm. Here it is. Here's the concepts. Here's how it plays. I would have loved to have heard from one of those players, this is awesome. I want to run it for my group. How do I do it? I don't think one session of D&D is quite enough to inspire someone to that level.
That makes sense. That makes sense. I'm always telling people around me that if it comes up that they should try running a session, and I don't have a very good answer for that actually. If they get a small scenario and you know feel free to do a lot of improvisational work with it. Jump in, there will be some things that you can improve and then, you know, add to it later on. That's how all of us did it.
Yep.
So,
I would say one obvious place where we can sort of spread, DMing experience is just within our own groups, right? You're at a table, you're running a game for six people. If you're meeting regularly, I'm sure you could use a break, not have burnout, say, hey, how about somebody else run a thing for us next week?
Yeah. It tends to be like the same people pick up on that sometimes. So the prospect of getting someone running it for brand new for the first time seems harder than cycling people that are accustomed to running games.
Do you think that it's a roadblock to folks? I'm just imagining my own situation if I was in front of a group of people I just run a game for and said, hey, how about you run a thing for us next week? And they know that I am a lunatic who thinks about D&D way more than he should and writes a blog and does live streams. And like maybe there's a little intimidation factor there that I need to like remove myself a little bit to say, yeah, you run this for others while I'm not here.
Are you talking about yourself or are you talking about me at this point? Are you talking about both of us?
Yeah, both of us really is what I'm getting at. Like, well, I guess that's the flip side, right, of that situation of, someone who's DM'd for his group for a while or her group for a while. If they, you know, at some point you start, the DM starts to be seen as sort of this, you know, Uber player.
Right.
Players to stand up and be like, I'm going to run for this person who obviously knows how to do it well.
Right. It seems like it. And actually, I mean, we have a couple acquaintances who have explicitly said that to me, actually, of like, oh, my God, I'm talking to this guy.
Do you mean specifically have said, I would love to run a game, but not for you, Dan?
Well, not that, but just okay. Actually, I've had people that were like intimidated being a player.
No, that's fine.
Yeah. You know, initially at least.
That's great. I don't think I have quite that notoriety. Awesome. Good for you. Yeah.
So there's a little bit there. So maybe what we should do is we should force people. We should actually have a requirement is you have to run a game for maybe even like half a session to get them over the hump. I don't know. That I'm sure that'll help with the intimidation factor when we demand people run games for us.
Forced running. If you want to be in my group, you got to run at least twice a year.
Yeah.
Oh, jeez. Yeah, it's tough, right? I think that's the part where my experiment was falling through, right? How do I find more people? How do I connect with people who are interested but don't know where to go?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, good for you for trying that. And, you know, in different places and different times, it's really hard to get a group together. So good for you for being welcoming and hospitable like that.
I think it's worth the effort. You know, so conventions, I guess, are another place where a lot of gamers come together, and possibly some people who aren't gamers or don't have experience with it but want it might show up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that libraries were a great thing to take a stab at, and you know, and then also I guess schools are too. Is a lot. So my mother's a school nurse up in Maine, and she wrote me a little while ago, like expressing real surprise that almost every school that she works with has a D&D group or a club. Sometimes with a teacher who doesn't know it very well, but the same thing was like, I had a whole bunch of students come and ask me wishing for a D&D club, so I felt obligated to try.
That's fascinating. I almost wonder now if that's an audience that is ripe of target the teachers who are stuck in that position of having to provide... Yeah. An experience for students where nobody knows what the heck they're doing.
Yeah, maybe so. And to my mother, it's really super ironic because I think you kind of missed this, but when I was getting into it, there was this whole moral panic scare going on. And I, you know, my parents were warned at least twice, like, you've got to not let Dan do this because it's going to warp his brain and he's going to become, you know, a immoral drug addict or something like that.
So
the fact that it's almost universal in a lot of schools now is really ironic for some of us.
I had one friend in school who was not explicitly by his parents not allowed to play because of exactly that. But I think my experience was that most parents, including my own, knew that that was all bunk.
Yeah. I think where I was, it was. I had... extended family members that it was disallowed for at least a while.
Okay. So can we expect new GMs to improvise? I think we can if we arm them with some good ways to do it, with material that provokes it and with nice guidance on how to do it.
Yeah. Simple, clear rules of thumb to get started with. Feel that you're going to improvise a lot, and then modify and improve on a later date.
Awesome.
People should do that.
Totally agree. Feels like we're wrapping up here, Dan. Do you have any last thoughts on either training new GMs or cultivating new DMs or improvisation in general?
I think that's pretty good. The more I work improvisation in my games, the happier I am, and the more flexibility, the more directions I think the game can go in.
Yeah, I mean, for me, the big thing that improv really does for me is it makes me feel like I'm also playing a game rather than performing to a bunch of people who are playing a game.
Wow,
that's what I want out of it, right? I wanna also play.
That's a great point. That's a great point.
Well, there you go. That's a great point.
Nice.
So let's end there.
Yeah. I'm glad we solved that one. We have solved another problem.
All right. Thanks, everyone, for joining us. We'll be back, I think, possibly in just 1 week. Is that right, Dan?
Yeah. A special holiday bonus episode on December 30th, Sunday.
Excellent. So we'll hopefully see some folks online then. I will try not to break all my equipment just moments before the stream. So that hopefully people know it's coming and maybe we'll see some chat going on. Otherwise, thanks for joining us, and we'll see you in a week.